This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Several weeks ago, we spoke with music archaeologist John Franklin. He gave us a taste of what ancient Greek music may have sounded like. Well, today we're taking you even deeper into the musical past, say 50,000 years. That's Dr. Yella Adama, a professor of biology and marine science at Boston University, an adjunct scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He studies sensory biology and how marine animals use multiple senses for navigation and communication. But as you just heard, he's also an accomplished musician and has a lifelong interest in the evolution of the flute. Yella Adama, tell us about this instrument that you've just been playing today and what we just heard you play.
Well, this is a cave bear bone flute that was found in Slovenia about 15 years ago. And it is a remarkable find, an old bone fossilized with a few holes in it that seemed to be really a flute. And no one believes that. So people are still trying to figure out, was it really just a bone that animals were gnawing on and making holes in with their teeth? From a zoological point of view, that makes no sense. And I simply think the logical interpretation is that it was a flute. And the remarkable thing is it was found with Neanderthal remnants. And so it is actually probably a Neanderthal flute from 50,000 years ago.
So you've made this argument that this is evidence that Neanderthals actually played their own music. Do we have any other evidence to support that? And do we have, I mean, in terms of what you just played, is that essentially just your imagining of what you could do with that flute?
You see, we always have to build models because we never know really what's going on. And to me, this is the best model we can come up with. But that is it. Your question, is this all we know? Yes. We have no idea that the Neanderthals were doing anything musical except there is this bone with holes in it. And if you can reconstruct it into a flute and make sound, as I just did, you can get a sense of what is possible. But there is no conclusive evidence that this was Neanderthals playing. Certainly, we have no idea what kinds of music Neanderthals were playing.
Now, you were doing some interesting things with your fingers as you were playing. It wasn't simply that you were, you know, placing your fingers over the holes. There was a little bit of kind of halfway over the holes and making these interesting notes in between the notes, I guess you might say.
Exactly. You can play around with any flute and do all sorts of strange things that are not sort of like your classical conservatory education flute playing. And you have to assume that these people could do all those things themselves. So when I demonstrate these flutes, I always make a very important point, is that it's nice that you have a pipe with holes, that therefore you can lift your fingers and get a different pitch. And it suggests that there is a scale, but it doesn't mean at all that they actually played that scale, because as you noticed, all the sliding and so forth can produce all sorts of sounds.
Now, you mentioned demonstrating these instruments. You've actually recorded playing this, I don't know, is it this instrument or a similar instrument, and that's part of an exhibit in the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
It was. It's no longer there. My very first reconstruction of a French flute was recorded and played for a couple decades in the museum.
Now, how did you get into this business, this hobby of studying and reconstructing ancient prehistoric flutes?
We're always interested in origins. Where did it come from? When did we become human? So my definition is we became human when we started playing music. So then you look for hard evidence, and the hard evidence is in the rocks. And so here is a flute, good bone. The oldest flute I just played is actually fossilized, so it really is a rock. So it's what you call hard evidence for something like music. And how did I get to it? Because I had a friend, John Pfeiffer, a science writer, who always would come by and ask what's new. And then he told me in passing that someone had reconstructed a 30,000-year-old flute, but no one could make a sound out of it. That was enough to me to say, well, I would like to try. And lo and behold, a few months later in the mail came that replicate flute to me, and I played on it. It took me more than a year to realize that I could not really get a good sound out of it, except if I played it in a very unoriginal way, that is upside down, where instead of the recorder you play down your lips. So I flipped it around, and suddenly it could make sound. Then I went to see the original in the British Museum and realized that exactly the thing that I had used to make sound did not exist in the original. So now we're back to square one. So then, of course, I took very careful measurements of that flute and reconstructed it, and that plays beautifully. Would you like to hear it?
I would. I would love to.
So that's this one here. So you can do all sorts of fun, wonderful things here. And again, as I mentioned, you have the scale idea. But that's not necessarily how they played, because, of course, they could do all this.
Wow. I mean, that's all coming from, you know, if we describe what you're playing on, it's, what, about a 5-inch long piece of bone, essentially. You've got one end kind of corked.
That's right. It is a deer bone and tibia, and I reconstructed carefully the four holes in the front, two holes in the back, and the missing piece. That was the trick that I could recognize as a flutist, that this probably was a recorder type of flute. And so that missing piece I left in, of course, in the reconstruction. So, but again, it is a model. It is a model of what I think the flute was in its original form. And this one is very spectacular. It plays wonderful music over an octave and a half or so, and you can really do a lot with it. You can play romantic songs. You can play screams and all sorts of animal sounds, for instance. So who knows what they used it for, but there is evidence of an old flute.
Now, you have in this box that you've brought with you three different bone flute replicates. Four. You've made multiple replicas. How diverse are the different forms that we find of these prehistoric flutes, and how much does it seem to change or evolve over time?
The youngest one I have here is a 4,000-year-old vulture bone flute that was found in southern France. And this one is exactly like the original. The only thing I had to do was put a little cork in the top. So it demonstrated to me that 4,000 years ago, these people were making recorder-type flutes.
Now, and when you say, you've mentioned that a couple of times, a recorder-type flute, and I should say when you're playing these, you're not holding them sideways to your face like you would a flute and blowing it to the top of it. You're holding it straight out from your face like a recorder and blowing into the end of it.
It is literally a recorder. It's called a fipple flute. It's the same sound-making mechanism that you find in organ pipes. So at the top, you blow into a hole or a slit, and that makes the turbulence that creates the sound. But it is technically a very complicated thing to do, because you have to really carve out a little air channel in the top of the flute, stopper it, and then it becomes easy to play. But it's not easy to conceive of how you would ever make a flute if you've never seen one like that. So that was my fascination. How far can we go back? So from this 4,000-year-old one, where it is clear that that is what it was, there's no doubt about it, you have to then leap back 30,000 years, and then 50,000 years to the Neanderthal flute. Now, the unfortunate thing at the moment is that the British Museum was not forthcoming about how old that flute is that I replicated. I still need to go back and force this issue. And in fact, I really am hoping that they will do carbon dating on it, because it's really an important transition instrument. If it is not as old as I was told it was, then that takes a chunk away from the evidence. But so far, we have the 4,000-year-old that was clearly a recorder-style flute. And would you like to hear it?
Well, sure. You could be playing a modern recorder.
Absolutely.
It sounds exactly like that. I mean, when you make these replicas, how important is it that you're actually using as close to the original materials as possible, that you're actually using a chunk of bone. Could you be doing this with, say, a piece of PVC pipe and essentially get the same sound, the same result?
Yeah, absolutely, you could. And the only difference is that the material of a flute does matter in the sound production. You get a different quality of sound. And it is very evident with this oldest flute that we started out with, the Neanderthal flute, because it's made. I made it out of a fossilized bone. The bone itself from the Viennese collection of cave bear bones is probably somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 years old. So now it's fossilized and it is more silicate than carbonate, whereas a fresh bone would be carbonate. The sound is completely different. If I reconstruct it as I have on a contemporary bear bone, it sounds very different and actually not as nice. So we have a real treasure here of time that the flute, the bear bone flute, now sounds better as a fossil than as an original.
We often talk here on Living Lab about interactions between scientists and artists, and you are both in one person. You study biology. You're not an archaeologist. You actually come to the study of the ancient flutes from your background as a flautist. And I wonder how your interactions with archaeologists, I mean, you say they had these and no one could make a sound on them. What are your relationships with archaeologists who study these things like?
I actually have no relationship with archaeologists, and they probably don't believe a thing I say because I'm not part of the club. The fields are so compartmentalized that it's hard to break through. And I've not taken the effort, I have to say, I'm a lazy guy, to sort of force the issue and to go to meetings and to demonstrate this in the proper environment of those people who consider themselves specialists.
Clearly, in your scientific life, you are publishing papers, you are participating in the scientific process, the full part of the scientific process, which includes peer review and sharing your findings and letting them be vetted by peers. It's curious to me that you don't find that perhaps important in this other exploration of yours, the exploration of ancient flutes.
Here is a question of time. I just do not have the time to do it. I have spent all my time at the moment to do these things in biology. And even in biology, I distribute my effort over a number of different issues. So it is literally a question of time. I would love to do it. I'm perfectly prepared to do it. And as you say, it is the combination of being a flutist and a scientist that actually allow me to see things that other people don't see. And the fact also that one wants to go back in a truly scientific way to go about what you can interpret and what you can actually not derive from it. Too many people jump to the conclusion that this was an instrument that they used to woo their girls and so forth. Who knows what they did with it? And then lots of people want to see that there was a pentatonic scale, because that seems to be the universal scale in the world for all ethno music. It's true, it's very common, but it doesn't mean it was the original scale. There was not any information we have what kind of scale people were playing 30 or 50,000 years ago. But it's likely that people were making music.
But it sounds to me like perhaps to you it doesn't matter if this is completely scientifically vetted. To you, this is more of about kind of communing with our ancestors and figuring out, as you said, this question of when we became human and what it means to be human.
No, I don't think so. I am very interested in the hard truth and in having it vetted. I vet it as hard as I can myself. I also disagree with a lot of stuff that is written about these flutes, particularly, for instance, the Neanderthal flute. There's a large proportion of people who dismiss this flute. Simply they say it's a bone with holes in it. An animal made it. No people made it. Neanderthals, no, we have no evidence. It was just found in an area where Neanderthal remains were also found. So first, as a zoologist, I say, when I see an animal gnaw on a bone, they don't use their canines to drill holes. They use their molars to crush it if they want to get at the marrow. So to drill actually two perfect holes, as you look at this flute that has these two major holes in there, they sort of look like canines would fit in there, but it is highly unlikely that any animal would have been able to drill a hole in a live bone, more freshly dead bone. So that's on that side. The other side, you have to say, well, if it was a flute, why not accept that Neanderthals make flutes? And a lot of people seem to have a hard time with that. The third part may actually be ethno-political, because in Germany they'd found swan bone flutes, which I still have not reconstructed. I'm still looking for a swan bone to do that. It's a very rather different looking flute, but it has all sorts of holes in a bird bone, which is perfect for a flute. So I'm completely convinced it's a flute, but we don't know how it was played. And the Germans have published very thorough articles in their musicologists and archaeologists' journals that this is the oldest musical instrument, thereby dismissing the Slovenian flute from the Neanderthals. But that's fine if they want to do it that way. One cannot argue one or the other, but personally, I think they are dismissing a flute that is 20,000 years older than the flute they found in Germany.
Now, in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about your scientific research, but as we said, you come to the study of the evolution of flutes as a flautist. You studied with the celebrated flautist Jean-Pierre Rampal, and for a time, as I understand, had potentially aspirations to being a professional flautist. Do you ever question your choice to put science first and go in a different direction?
I had no choice. I mean, these are the things, you know, as a good boy, I was listening to my mother and I studied biology instead of going to a conservatory. But being myself, I also pursued the music anyway, in parallel with my biological studies. So the interesting thing is that while in the early part of my career, I certainly would have preferred to go the musical route and did the biology, well, sort of as a secondary direction. And yet, of course, I spend most of my time doing biology. So it's a very curious dichotomy here. Finally, in mid-career, I decided, hey, biology, science is actually fantastic. Look what I've already done. And at that point, I got very excited in a different way, in an emotional way, to pursue the career in science. But to have this happen halfway during your career, that is really strange.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with sensory biologist and amateur flautist Dr. Jelle Adema. We'll explore his research on how marine animals communicate and navigate after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. According to recent research, the human nose can sniff out 1 trillion distinct smells. A sensitive nose could help us avoid spoiled food or even choose an appropriate mate. But for many animals, particularly in the ocean, olfaction can be an important navigation aid and a means of communication. That's what Dr. Jelle Adema studies when he has his scientist hat on. He's a professor of biology and marine science at Boston University and adjunct scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He studies sensory biology and how sharks, lobsters, and even robots can use multiple senses for navigation and communication. Now, Jelle Adema, just before the break, you were talking about how kind of mid-career you finally connected really with what you were your research topic and started to get really excited. So tell us about what was going on at that point in your research. What was it that finally got you so excited about your research in biology?
I think I had not recognized what my mother long ago recognized, that I actually was very interested in biology. So I love observing animals and I love to try and understand what makes them tick. I always think I should be in the head of an animal to figure out how it looks at its world. And I gave once a Friday night talk at MBL called To Be a Lobster. And that sort of says it all. I'd like to be a shark. I'd like to be a larval reef fish of only 1 centimeter long and find out what I can extract from the underwater world. So this has always been there. And so of course, science is a lot of fun. And it's a wonderful endeavor. Finally, it is really practical because you cannot be an amateur biologist and a professional flutist. But you can turn it around. You can be an amateur flutist and have a lot of fun and play with a lot of wonderful people in great venues. So that is, I have complete peace with that, and I'm very happy in that combination.
So you were saying you'd like to be a lobster, and a lot of our listeners may be familiar with the book from a few years ago, Trevor Corson's book, The Secret Life of Lobsters. What secrets about being a lobster could you share with us?
The very first discovery we had, and I should, of course, give credit to dozens and dozens of students who have worked with me on the lobster, was that there is a sex pheromone that brings male and female lobsters together and allows them to pair bond for a short time for mating purposes. So that was totally unknown at the time. We're talking about my early days in 1970 at the Oceanographic Institution, where they charged me with the task of describe for us the underwater chemical signaling. And there was really nothing known, virtually nothing, little bits and pieces. So to me, that sounded like a good endeavor. And what we found in the lobster is a number of things that not only the sex pheromone, of course, they also have to sense their food. So they can discriminate food at a very fine, in a very fine way. They can tell the difference between different muscles, for instance. Muscle species. The most remarkable thing we found ultimately was done by my graduate student, Christy Karavanich, who figured out that they could recognize individuals by odor. So when lobsters fight, another thing we discovered is that they actually, they produce a squirt of breath that is from their gills in which they inject urine. So the urine gets dispersed to the front, blowing out in front of the animal, and they blow it in each other's face as they're fighting. So you get a noseful of urine when you're fighting with the other lobster. They remember this urine odor as an individual. The loser remembers the winner's odor, and he only will remember it if in the fight he actually gets crunched. So if you prevent during the fight that the winner and the loser can use their claws, they will not remember the odor. So it's a very straightforward case. You fight, you get crunched, you hurt, and at the same time you smell this awful urine odor, and you remember that. And they remember it for about a week, maybe 10 days. At the moment, I have a new student who is working with me on an extension of this because she decided she wanted to test omega-3s. As an extension of memory and increased vigor-inducing agent. So at the moment, what we found out is that we're still in the process of it, but that, in fact, memory seems to be prolonged in animals that have omega-3s added to their diet.
So this is, I mean, like omega-3 fatty acids that, yep, we keep hearing are so good for us.
Exactly.
It could actually be boosting. Is it specifically this memory of smell or memory in general?
Well, that we don't know. So it was when the student came up to me and wanted to test omega-3s, I thought, well, we have heard in the general press that it might be good for your memory. Not that I necessarily believe it, but that's what's going on. So it's an undergraduate project, and I love those projects because it doesn't matter how it comes out. They just need to do good science. And if they come with an interesting question, for me it's more important that they have fun asking their question and get a good answer, whether it's yes or no. And so in this case, it was the omega-3s. And what I could connect it with is that we know about memory in lobsters. And so does it extend their memory of a fight? So that's what we're still trying to find out.
Now, how does the ability or I guess even the application of olfaction by marine animals differ from how land animals use? I mean, land animals also have pheromones and use that. But is there something fundamentally different either about the animal's biology or simply the fact of being in the medium of water that makes olfaction different from marine animals?
It's a very good question. And the answer is there's basically no difference whether you pick up the chemicals from air or from water. Of course, in detail, there is a lot of difference because the chemicals have to be dissolved in water as opposed to being volatile in air. But if you really look at the structure of a fish nose or a human nose, they're not that different. The same kinds of receptor cells, the same kind of brain hooked up to it, the same diversity of chemicals that can be smelled. The only difference is that if you look at the genome of fish versus rodents versus humans, you get a different picture that there are far more receptors for different odors in the mammals than there are in fish.
Hmm. Now, you also, of course, study not only lobsters, but sharks. And sharks are kind of notorious, I think, for the fact that despite, you know, being incredible predators, they don't actually have very good eyesight and they rely very heavily on their noses. So tell us a little bit about shark olfaction and what we know about how sensitive their nose is and what they're using it for.
I don't think that their noses are particularly more sensitive than of other fish. There's enormous variety among sharks and amongst other fish and amongst all land animals in the sensitivity to different odors. So the strange thing is, really, I do not believe that sharks are exceptional in that respect. If you look at them and know where the story comes from, it is they have a very large nose. And if you look in their brain, they have a very large nose brain, the olfactory bulb. So it makes sense to reason to think that they would be exceptionally attracted to odors and can detect great dilutions. Of course, fishermen have that experience. You chum the area and sharks are attracted. So are other fish. So in detail, once you start really quantifying it, it turns out to be not that different. Even if you look single amino acid detection or complex odor detection, which we are in fact in the middle of right now, we don't see that much difference. The most sensitive thing I've ever measured in an animal was in tuna, where we measured 10 to the minus 14 molar, which is, I would say, probably about 100,000 times more sensitive than what we find off in the
land. We're talking like homeopathic concentrations at this point.
A little more than that. Exactly. Exactly. It was absolutely amazing. It was an unusual amino acid, tryptophan. And so, yeah, there's a non-shark, but with a fantastic nose.
Now, when you compare all of these different animals, you can just figure out how many olfactory receptors, how many actual receptors they have for different smells. But of course, as you were mentioning, one of the things that really varies is brain size. So do we have a sense, especially from comparing different animals, of how much of sensory sensitivity, I guess, is a factor of just having enough receptors, and how much of it is having the brain to interpret all of those different signals?
They're both very important. The sensitivity question is answered by the number of receptors. If you want to detect very few molecules, you need very many receptors. It is this simple law. If you have a lot of molecules like sugar in our mouth, you don't need many receptors. So that's that part. The other part is what information you extract from those receptor cells. And that's where the brain comes in. So for instance, when I worked on catfish, I noticed that they had very large olfactory brains, as opposed to a stickleback, which has a very small nose. So then sticklebacks, yes, they have large eyes and do most of the things by eyes, but catfish seem to be doing an awful lot of things through their nose, interpreting social behavior, food behavior, and so forth.
Now, you've recently been studying larval coral reef fish who actually use a sense of smell to find an appropriate home, to find where they're supposed to settle. So tell us what you're learning about them.
So one point I need to make in general is that odor has no directionality per se. Odor, we only know where the odor is. It's in our nose. Where it came from is very hard to figure out because it travels on all these air currents or water currents, depending where you live. And so the same for these larval reef fishes. They can detect what kind of odor it is and then make decisions whether that's an odor they want to do something with, how they want to follow it, whether they want to get away from it. So for the reef fishes, what we discovered is that they can detect a difference in odor between two reefs that are only a few miles apart. Washed by the same ocean, inhabited by the same plants and animals, you would think it would be the same. But on the other hand, think about you walk into someone's house and you say, oh, yeah, this is grandma's house. You know, smell right away. It's not that different from the house next door, but there are subtle differences. The nose is exquisitely equipped, the nose and the brain, to detect these subtle differences. So when we found that out, we said, aha. So they know that they're near their home after their dispersal. You know how it goes, right? So these larval reef fish are born. They transport it out of the reef for several weeks, and then they have to come back. If they don't, they die.
So, I mean, how are they being transported? We're talking about, microscopic baby fish. How are they? Are they just floating on the currents, or are they actively swimming to some place that they want to call home?
They're passively floating out. In some fish, it is the eggs that are floating out, sometimes the hatched larvae. In the beginning, the first few days, they cannot swim, or at least barely. So they're passively transported out together with the odor of the reef. So you have to see that as a package. They get born on the reef. They carry out with the water masses that carry them out, but also the odor of the reef. So they have several days in which they can smell that odor of the reef in a tiny little nose that they have at the time and remember it. And then weeks later, they can use that information to find out if they're still near their own reef or some other reef. Some fish may be okay going to a different reef, but we have more and more evidence that they actually want to go home. So some may be carried farther away from the reef than they would be able to swim back unless they could avoid this faraway carrying, and we just discovered that that is a sun compass. So they actually have a compass based on the position of the sun and the time of day. Can you imagine? A fish, you know, the size of your pinky nail. So they have a sun compass that tells them you should swim southeast because you have been, in all likelihood, been drifting to the north-northwest.
All right. So we've now talked about lobsters who remember smells to remember the other lobsters they should stay away from, somebody who beat them in a fight, and sharks who use sense of smell to find food, and larval coral reef fish who are using their sense of smell essentially to find the right place to call home. How many different ways do marine organisms use a sense of smell? Do we even have a sense?
I think practically every organism under or above water uses smell. It's ubiquitous because it is so good at identifying the source of the smell. It has enormous amounts of information, also for humans. I mean, look at your pet dog is a famous example, of course. They tell the difference by nose.
Now, with climate change, we are also, of course, seeing changes in ocean chemistry, the ocean becoming more acidic. That changes certain mineral availability, has a whole cascade of chemical effects in the ocean. And there's some indication that some of these chemical changes could actually affect the ability of marine organisms to use their sense of smell.
Recent studies, including one that we did ourselves on sharks, have shown that there is, in fact, a defect coming in with increased acidification. And what we don't know is if this is a long-lasting effect, whether the animals over time gradually can adapt to this kind of a situation. And the real problem is we really don't know the mechanism by which this effect takes place. If we knew, we could have a better prediction of where the animals would become vulnerable.
I mean, if we were to go to a worst-case scenario where essentially sense of smell is all but knocked out, what are some of the effects that we might see, not just on the individual level, but at the level of populations or species?
If for a shark the sense of smell was knocked out, it would die.
They wouldn't be able to find food.
Gone. Done. And that's the thing that alerts them. There are some visual sharks that could see their prey and still hunt visually. But the problem is underwater, vision does not go very far. Often the water is cloudy. Even if it's not cloudy, there's a lot of scatter. So it's at most a few hundred meters that you can see underwater in very clear conditions.
And now you said that we're not sure yet whether the impacts of these changes in chemistry are permanent or whether they're reversible. But for the case, say, of a larval coral reef fish, that's kind of a moot point. Because if they don't have their sense of smell in tip-top shape at the exact right moment, then that's it.
No, that's true. But the change, the acidity change, will take place over a very long period of time, over decades. And so what we are talking about is not individual adaptation to these conditions, but genetic adaptation, so that the progeny of these fishes gradually get exposed to more and more acidic water and therefore may lead to an evolution in other words, the selection of those animals that are better capable to work under more acidic conditions.
And are you confident that animals can evolve at a rate sufficient to meet this challenge?
We don't know. We have absolutely no idea. Sometimes selection can take place pretty fast. There are some documented cases of pretty quick adaptation, for instance, to visual patterns. But for odor and for smelling, we don't know that.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Jelle Adema about his studies of sensory biology in marine organisms. After a short break, we'll talk more about how robots might be able to make use of his findings and also how he combines his passion for art and science in teaching. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Jelle Adema of Boston University and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about his research in sensory biology, his amateur study of prehistoric flutes, and how he marries his passions for art and science. Now, Jelle Adema, before the break, we were talking about the importance of essentially the sense of smell for a variety of marine organisms. And recently, you've actually been putting some of your findings to work, trying to create robots or assist others in creating robots that might be able to mimic this behavior and actually use essentially a sense of smell for navigation. So how's that going?
The robot work has already ended, and I'll tell you why. We started it because we wanted to test an animal, in this case an artificial animal, that can only smell, no detection of anything else. So we gave it two sensors, and we thought, well, if they can really orient by odor alone, then the two sensors, if you say turn in the direction of the one that is most strongly stimulated, should get them near the source or not. Well, it turned out to be yes, but only if the odor plume is very coherent. As you look at the smokestack, you see the smoke coming out, and initially it is coherent, and then it breaks up in patches. So as soon as it breaks up in patches, this robot, instructed as I explained, will end up in the center of a patch and float away from the source. So that's what we found.
So it gets completely confused, basically. It can't do what animals are able to do.
Exactly. And so this simply underscores what we've been saying, is that what the animals really need to locate the source of an odor is flow detection. The odor tells them that it's worthwhile pursuing, but the flow detectors will get them there. At the time, we did not have very good flow detectors at the scale of the animal. We were very proud of our olfactory detectors. They were really properly scaled. We were very proud of the thermos can on wheels, as someone called it, which was our robot. Didn't look like a lobster at all, but it was patterned after a lobster, so it could carry and move the odor detectors through the water the way a lobster would. Well, it was a very nice start, but as I said, at some point we concluded that we were right, that you need flow, and that was the end of the robot experiment so far. We could pick it up potentially if we get good flow detectors.
Well, so, I mean, we often think of this as being a one-way flow of information, I think, from you do your basic research, you learn something about how a plant or an animal works, and then, at least in the area of biomimicry, which has become so hot, that you would use that information to create some sort of technology from it. But what you're saying is that actually in attempting to create that technology, that's actually taught you something about the animals themselves and about what it takes to do what they are capable of doing.
Yes, and we have done these experiments with lobsters and with sharks, and I would want to maybe dwell on the shark because we've published a number of really interesting things recently with my student Jane Gardner, who's now in Florida, on shark detecting of odors and tracking odor plumes. And so it's very clear that they use the odor to identify and get excited about it and then use their lateral line to home in on the source, to track the plume to the source. By doing lesion experiments and eliminating their lateral line, we basically now have a shark that cannot sense the flow, and they could not find the source. They use the lateral line also to identify what kind of source it is in great detail. So the flow detectors are immensely important.
Now, there are vehicles out there that are able to follow essentially a gradient, different levels of some chemical. I believe these were used after the Gulf oil spill and have been used in very... So what's different about them from the robot that you were trying to build that was not so successful?
Well, let me turn around a little bit. What I would love to do is collaborate in this sense with ocean-going vehicles and have different sensors, animal-based sensors, mimicked onto these underwater vehicles, because we do have a pretty good idea, learned from animals, particularly from sharks, what kind of sensors they need in order to get to the odor source. So if we mimic those sensors and coordinate those sensors all together on the underwater vehicle, we stand a much better chance to actually be able to track the odor plumes.
Now, talk a little bit about the sensors that you actually were using. I mean, what actually goes into creating a robotic nose?
There are two aspects to it. One is to have the right detectors to pick up the chemicals you're interested in, let's say a BP oil detector. The other thing would be an algorithm that tells you how to use the information together with flow to stay connected with the odor plume. And in sharks, what we found out is that if you look at the time of arrival between the two nostrils, that gives them information where the odor patch is. So when they encounter a patch of odor, not necessarily the whole plume, but just a patch of the plume, that allows them to immediately turn into the patch. And as a plume is basically a stream of patches, that allows them to stay connected with the plume. And that is the major task. If you lose the plume, it is very difficult to find it back. For us, it's hard to imagine because we look at plumes with our eyes. So we can always see where the plume is going. But that's not how it's done underwater or how animals are doing it, even in air.
I mean, it's a matter of trying to, you know, being in the forest as opposed to above the forest, right?
Exactly.
It's a very different
navigation
right. problem.
Very good analogy, yeah.
Now, I wonder how much of you know, what animals are doing and how they're interpreting what they're smelling is kind of behavioral. I mean, we've talked about what it takes to actually pick up the odor, the nose part, the brain part, but how much of it is behavior that enables them to stay in the plume and to cope with this information?
So this shark story actually is a very good example of that because we'd never expected exactly what would happen. I was interested in time differences to see if that has information. Why do you have two nostrils? Either to detect concentration differences or arrival time differences. Well, concentration didn't work, we know that. So we did arrival time. And lo and behold, the shark turns to the nostril that was hit first.
It does. Okay, so let's stop for a second, though. How far apart are a shark's nostrils?
The shark we were working with was about 5 centimeters.
So, I mean, we use our ears.
Yep.
Two different ears. Arrival time of sound helps us triangulate where a sound is coming from. Our nostrils are right next to each other. How much of a difference in arrival time could we possibly be talking about, and how do you differentiate that?
Good point. First of all, sound is, of course, very fast, whereas odor flow is very slow by comparison. So the arrival times are pretty much slowed down with the flow. And it'd be surprising because if even in our nose, in a normal wind that we can experience, there would be a few, say, tens of milliseconds difference in arrival time. Sharks can analyze that. So the arrival times of a few tens of milliseconds is enough for them to know that this was hit before the other. Their reaction then to turn into it allows them to stay connected with the plume. So this is a reflex that they are, in a way, that they are employing. As soon as they get bang, bang, nostrils are touched, half a second later they turned already into it. Now, if you do that on a consistent basis with every patch in the odor plume, you stay with the plume and you go to the source.
Now, in addition to your research and your flute playing, you also teach at Boston University. And you use an unusual range of materials. I mean, this seems to be one area where perhaps you can really marry your passions for art and your passion for science. So tell us a little bit about what you put into your teaching and the development of your curricula.
I think it's important for students, particularly early in their career, to realize that they don't necessarily have to 100% specialize in one particular direction. A lot of people feel that is necessary in order to be competitive. I beg to differ. I think it's actually very important to keep your mind open in all sorts of different directions. You never know where the connections are going to come, for instance, with the old flutes. So what I try to impart on the students is to stay broad, to have a few areas of specialization that you can combine at some point, but to not close the door on all sorts of other things. And a lot of students are very grateful for that. They wanted to be dancers. They wanted to be musicians. They wanted to, who knows, all sorts of things that everyone is basically interested in. And then they feel compelled to just close that down and focus 100% on getting high SAT scores and GRE scores and what have you. So when I talk to freshmen particularly, and recently I've been teaching freshman course at Boston University, for non-majors, I try to lay the connection between sensing and science. You know, sensing is science, but sensing is also going to the museum and look at beautiful paintings. So why do we think the painting is beautiful? What are we actually seeing? How is our brain interpreting what the painter is putting on the canvas? And suddenly you open up and you realize, if you really go to the science of seeing, of vision, you realize that most of it we make up. It's not there. It's very strange. The best place to show that is with the so-called optical illusions. We create images out of suggestions that it might be that. The brain jumps to the conclusion that that's how it is.
So it's less about actually the science of vision and more about psychology or neurobiology.
That's right. But sensing in this sense is neurobiology, and sensing in this case is also the psychology of vision and smelling and so forth. And it's true for all our senses, for hearing as well.
Now, speaking of hearing, you use a noise machine sometimes with your students. So how do they respond to that? What's the context for that, and how do they respond?
Well, that was a very interesting thing. I just asked them the question, what is music? And so we had a debate, and everyone had a different opinion, of course. And so I pulled out this awful noise instrument that's shaking and noising and making horrible noises, frightening noises. And as I was shaking it for just maybe a minute or so, I asked them, so who thinks this is music? Most of the class thought it was music. So I was very impressed with their broad-mindedness.
And or did they think that was what they were supposed to tell you?
Well, you never know that. But I was also actually trying to figure out why they thought so. And I think it is because I couldn't help myself and make rhythmical patterns with this noise.
Now, it kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, you've also used John Cage sitting at a piano in silence. So is that music if you're sitting in front of an instrument and not doing anything? And what is the lesson there for students?
I enacted John Cage in that same lecture and told him that I would play John Cage's famous piece, and sat behind the grand piano in dead silence and then stood up and took a bow, just what John Cage did in the original performance. And so they started giggling and laughing and so forth. But it is music, because what John Cage wanted to do is say, listen, just listen. And when you're totally silent, you realize that it's not total silence. There's all sorts of background music going on, like at Boston University, the traffic on the big road that goes right through campus. And what I do often in social settings, in a bar, when a group of people gets together, they make a noise. And that noise, you can tell simply by listening to it whether they're happy or not. So there are happy crowds and unhappy crowds. In the subway, it's very interesting to listen to the noise when you stand there packed in with all these other people. So that is basically, I think, what John Cage was after. And what he called music, his definition was organized sound.
Well, speaking of organized sound, you, of course, don't only play Neanderthal bone flutes. You brought with us, brought with you today, your modern flute. And I wonder if you could leave us with a little something.
Oh, I'd love to do that. Maybe we can play a little bit of Schubert, a very famous little melody by Schubert.
Dr. Yella Adama of Boston University and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Living Lab. Tune in next week for a conversation about the environmental footprint of scientific research and also a preview of the Cape Cod Makers Fair. If you like what you hear, you can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.